August the 15th, in Delhi and all over India, was a day of rejoicing. August the 15th was Independence Day. It was also the day of partition. The sun had not long risen on August the 15th, 1947, when the meaning of partition was made clear. To divide a subcontinent, not along natural or historic frontiers, but according to religion, to create out of well-mixed populations a Muslim Pakistan and a predominantly Hindu India, was a task which appalled by its sheer difficulty and by the suffering which it must cause. In Calcutta, traditional storm center of Indian politics, where violence was always expected, one man stood in the path of fanaticism and massacre, Mahatma Gandhi. Gandhi began a fast, which he threatened to continue till death, if the communities did not end their strife. The miracle worked. Gandhi's presence in Bengal, said Mountbatten, was worth four divisions of soldiers. In the Punjab, the story was sadly different. There, despite all the efforts of the boundary force and men of goodwill of all races, massacres of Hindus by Muslims, Muslims by Hindus, generally headed by the warrior caste of Sikhs, were producing horrible loss of life and dreadful destruction. They produced also a new problem, born of fear, the refugees. By August the 27th, Mountbatten calculated that some 10 million people were on the move.
It was a terrible situation. The very existence of the new dominion seemed to be at stake. The refugee problem was out of all control. There was a serious food shortage, a complication never far off in Indian crises. And of course, there was the danger of epidemics. It would have seemed sheer carelessness not to do all I could.
Once more, in a time of danger and difficulty, Mountbatten found at his side an incalculable support. While he struggled to avert further perils, Lady Mountbatten bent her astonishing energies to mending the damage already done, as far as that was possible. Slowly, as the emergency committee gripped its task under Mountbatten's guidance, the communal crisis was brought under control, leaving an inevitable legacy of hate and destruction behind.
In the midst of all this drama, there came a wonderful family occasion. In fact, one of the great moments in the history of our family. On November the 20th, 1947, my nephew Philip, who is now Duke of Edinburgh, was married to Princess Elizabeth, the heir to the throne. I wasn't sure whether I'd even be able to attend the wedding, but the Indian government said that if I didn't, that would make the atmosphere of crisis in India even worse. Prince Philip, of course, was more like a son than a nephew to Edwina and to me. I've been very pleased to see how well he was doing in the Navy. I firmly believed that a naval training was the best possible training for royal duties which he would now have to perform. Princess Elizabeth herself was very close to our family. In age, she comes just in between our own two daughters, Patricia and Pamela. So I had watched her grow up. I had always been extremely fond of her, and our relationship became steadily closer. When this great state occasion was over, to our delight, the Princess and Philip accepted our invitation to spend their honeymoon at our house, Broadlands, where Edwina and I had so happily spent the first part of ours. For most people in Britain, the royal wedding provided a marvellous and cheering splash of colour in the midst of austerity. But by now, I was back in India, where the crisis atmosphere was still intense.
In India, the Muslims found a new and unexpected champion, Gandhi. Once again, Gandhi, now living in Birla House, Delhi, threatened a fast to the death to induce the government of India to deal fairly with Pakistan and to reduce communal violence. Once again, Gandhi's miracle worked. He ended his fast on January the 18th, 1948. But 12 days later, the Mahatma was killed by the bullet of a Hindu fanatic.
To say that I was appalled conveys nothing. I was absolutely numbed and petrified. I went round at once to Birla House. There was a large crowd round the house already, and inside, most of the members of the government. Everyone in tears. Gandhi looked very peaceful in death, but I dreaded what his death might bring.
The demonstration of feeling at Gandhi's funeral was fantastic even by Indian standards. Pandit Nehru had expressed the depth of this feeling in a broadcast to the Indian people.
The light has gone out of our lives, and there is darkness everywhere. And I do not quite know what to tell you and how to say it. Our beloved leader, Bapu as we called him, the father of the nation, is no more.
When Gandhi's body reached the burning ground beside the river Jamuna, an enormous crowd thronged around the bier, creating such pressure that for a time it appeared that Mountbatten and all the other dignitaries might even be thrust into the flames. "We must all sit down," said Mountbatten. Everyone sat down, and so held back the weeping, hysterical crowd.
When I come to Delhi and I visit Gandhi's shrine, I always recall the little bent figure who played such a very large part in India's history, and who called Edwina and me his dear friends. Without that friendship, I could never have carried out my task.
In June, the time came for Mountbatten to leave India. 15 months of the most strenuous and intense activity of even his strenuous career now drew to an end. On June the 21st, 1948, he handed over the office of Governor General to C.R. Rajagopalachari, Rajaji. Now, with the death of Gandhi, the most venerable of India's statesmen, a fitting figure to be the first Indian Governor General of free India. In these last days, the people of India made their feelings towards Mountbatten and towards his family unmistakably clear. In the words of an Indian politician at the time of independence, "At last, after 200 years, the British have conquered India."
Lord Brabourne, Lord Mountbatten's son-in-law, has this to say.
"When my father-in-law came back from India, the whole family was there to meet him, and so was Mr. Attlee. It wasn't very long after this that Lord Mountbatten became aware that in certain circles he'd made himself extremely unpopular. The partition troubles and the loss of life which resulted from them had been wildly distorted in some parts of the press, and he was blamed for what had happened. In particular, some conservatives, who had begun by congratulating him, now turned against him and accused him of breaking up the empire. He found that some old friends were avoiding him, and the whole family was affected by this spitefulness, as I discovered personally. Perhaps the most hurtful thing was that his friend, Sir Winston Churchill, whom he had known and revered all his life, now refused to speak to him. It was a bad time for my father-in-law, although he would try to brush it all aside and say, history would be the judge. But the atmosphere was not a happy one for doing what he was absolutely determined to do, starting all over again in the Navy. He had extracted a promise from the Prime Minister and the Admiralty, even before he went to India, that he'd be allowed to do this. So now, in October 1948, he reverted to substantive rank of Rear Admiral and went to command the 1st Cruiser Squadron in Malta."
Mountbatten was 48 years old. In the little island of Malta, the ex-Supremo, ex-Viceroy, ex-Governor-General ranked 13th in the order of social precedence. In the Mediterranean fleet, he was under the command of officers who'd served under him in Southeast Asia. He thought this was a very good thing. In 1949, Mountbatten was promoted to Vice-Admiral. Further promotions followed. In 1950, 4th Sea Lord of the Admiralty. In 1952, Commander-in-Chief Mediterranean. In the troubled condition of the world, for war leaders like Mountbatten, new duties now unfolded. At the end of the Second World War, the victorious Red Armies stood in the heart of Europe. The Soviet Union annexed whole countries and provinces, amounting to over 200,000 square miles and containing nearly 25 million people. Eastern Europe, with another 87 million people, fell under Soviet domination. The aggressive expansion of the Soviet Union posed a clear threat to the Western democracies and to the ideals for which they had fought the war. In February 1948, a communist coup brought Czechoslovakia into the Soviet orbit. In July, the Russians began the Berlin blockade, which was only defeated by a massive airlift. Alarmed and angry, the democracies took action. In April 1949, the United States, France, and Britain joined with nine other countries to form the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Ernest Bevin, British Foreign Secretary, was one of its principal founders. In June 1951, a NATO military command was set up, with General Eisenhower as Supreme Commander Europe and Field Marshal Montgomery as his deputy. Bit by bit, a new organization was created, and subsidiary commands were formed. In March 1953, Mountbatten was appointed Commander-in-Chief, Allied Forces Mediterranean, with his headquarters in Malta. Mountbatten's tour of duty in the Mediterranean ended in December 1954 on a note of splendor. The six admirals, representing the Allied commanders-in-chief under him, formed a crew and rowed him to his flagship. It was a fitting tribute to his happy and triumphant return to the sea.
I've seen enormous changes in my lifetime. In fact, I've had quite a lot to do with some of them. But one thing I'm happy to say has not changed. When I reached the last phase of my career and fulfilled ambitions I'd hardly dare to admit, even to myself, a new queen was on the throne, and the British monarchy was as strong and well-loved as it was when I was born.
Ceremonial returned in a blaze of light and color. The pageant of the coronation in June 1953 brightened the austerities of the post-war scene. In the crowded London streets, not even drenching rain could diminish the enthusiasm as the young queen went by.
12 days after Anthony Eden became Prime Minister, my life's ambition was fulfilled. I became First Sea Lord. Actually, it was Winston Churchill who was responsible for the appointment, one of his last acts in high office. That made him the only man to have appointed a father and son to the post of First Sea Lord. It also meant that he got over his hard feelings about what I'd done in India. So here I was, on the Board of Admiralty, the First Sea Lord, the professional head of the Royal Navy.
In 1955, 10 years after the Second World War, Britain possessed unchallenged great power status. Yet significant changes were already at work, closely affecting Mountbatten and the other chiefs of staff. Ever present in their minds was the new dilemma, the Cold War, the bitter clash between the Soviet Union and her wartime Western allies. In June 1956, Colonel Nasser, the firebrand of Egyptian politics, became president of the Republic of Egypt. Egypt's economy was backward, her poverty chronic. To remedy this, Colonel Nasser sought backing for a new irrigation scheme, the Aswan High Dam. Britain and America informed him in July that they would not finance this project. 1 week after this Anglo-American decision, Nasser announced the nationalization of the Suez Canal. The Suez Crisis of 1956 had begun. On November the 15th, a United Nations peacekeeping force arrived in the Suez area, and shortly afterwards the British and French withdrew. The dispute over this fiasco has never died away. On January the 9th, 1957, ill health compelled Anthony Eden to resign. He was succeeded as Prime Minister by Harold Macmillan. In July 1959, Mountbatten was appointed Chief of the Defence Staff. The event marked the inauguration of the most sweeping changes ever to take place in the British Armed Forces.
What was happening now was really the conclusion of something which began as far back as 1941, when I went to combined operations. That was when the idea of inter-service really took hold of me. In combined operations, we demonstrated that it was possible for Army, Navy, and Air Force people to sync their service identities completely and work as one outfit.
All through the years of Mountbatten's eminence, his image had been coupled with another, Edwina Mountbatten, Lady Louis, as she was known to many thousands. Their public lives had dramatically come together during the war, when Lady Mountbatten had risen as swiftly to the top in her own field, the Red Cross and St. John, as her husband in the sphere of high command. In Southeast Asia, they had worked closely together on the rescue and repatriation of prisoners of war. In India, as Vice Reign, Lady Mountbatten had made an unforgettable impact, among ordinary people, perhaps greater than her husband's. She had been seen and admired at Mountbatten's side when he resumed his naval career in 1948 and climbed the ladder from Rear Admiral to First Sea Lord. But her work for the Red Cross and St. John never ceased. She gave herself to this without stint, refusing to recognize the clear symptoms of illness through overwork.
The warmth and the spirit of American generosity has touched us more deeply than I can ever hope to tell you. But I want you to believe how vital and invaluable your help has been to us, how much we have relied on it in the hours of our greatest needs, and the immense gratitude we feel towards you.
In February 1960, there was a happy family occasion, the wedding of the Mountbatten's younger daughter, Pamela, to the interior decorator, David Hicks.
My wife, Edwina, was on the top of her form at Pamela's wedding. I'd never known her more gay, more happy, more lovely in recent years. Everybody remarked on it. As somebody said afterwards, it was like a candle that flares up just before it gutters and goes out. 4 days after the wedding, she went away on a tour of the Far East as superintendent-in-chief of St. John. She shouldn't have gone, of course, but we couldn't stop her. We tried to get her to cut down her program, but typically she wouldn't hear of it. She must have been dying on her feet, but her sense of duty drove her on right to the end. I found out afterwards that on the last night of her life, after a full day in Borneo, she insisted on going to an official party. Two ladies had to support her by the elbows as far as the door. And then she pushed them aside and drew herself erect and walked in and sparkled, as she always did. That night she went to bed and never woke again. I heard the news by telephone, I suppose, about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. It was a Pollack's blow. I simply couldn't grasp it. I didn't have time to, because as soon as the news came out, the heavens opened. I received over 6,000 telegrams and letters from kings, presidents, prime ministers, governors. But what astonished me, at least 5,000 of them were from people in all walks of life, from many countries, who said they were her personal friends. I'm sure they were, and yet I'd never even heard of them. Edwina had asked in her will to be buried at sea. I wasn't too sure about this, but I was wrong. The First Sea Lord at once offered a frigate. Not only that, he came down himself, and with him the Commander-in-Chief, Portsmouth, and all his senior officers. And the Indian government insisted that one of their frigates should accompany her as her last Indian escort. I was deeply touched at this unique tribute from two navies. And it was then, I think, as we committed her to the sea, that the sense of loss really came home to me.
Mountbatten returned to work a lonely figure, without the brave and brilliant woman who had supported him for so long, but no less dedicated to the work which he had set in hand. He was due to retire in 1962, but the Prime Minister prevailed on him to stay on.
After I became CDS, I was able to reintroduce supreme command, or unified command as we now call it, in all our overseas theatres. In the Far East, as it turned out, this happened just in time.
In 1962, British policy was to set up a Malaysian federation, which would add economic and political unity to the fragmented independence of that part of Southeast Asia. The implementation of this policy put Mountbatten's apparatus to its first test.
The services worked splendidly together, and they all had a hard job to do. Confrontation ended in 1966. We'd won this war quietly, efficiently, and at very low cost in life. By this time, I had retired from the post of Chief of the Defence Staff. It was gratifying to me that the last major enterprise of the services in which I was involved should have had such a happy outcome. Saying goodbye, of course, was not so happy. It's a bleak moment when you realize that you've reached the end of something that has occupied almost the whole of your life. I've been in uniform for 52 years. I'd always been proud of that uniform, proud and happy.
How will the future remember Lord Mountbatten of Burma? An impossible question. He has always lived in the future. He still does. Matters which concern him today have yet to reveal their future significance and value. But the present achievement remains a very large story, even if incomplete. Will the Navy remember the wireless specialist, the communicator, or the dashing Captain D5, whose ship sank under him in the Battle of Crete? Or the son who followed his father as First Sea Lord and then abolished the Board of Admiralty? Will history remember him as the pioneer of military techniques who paved the way for D-Day and the successful invasion of Europe in 1944? Already fickle memory tends to forget the supreme commander who liberated Burma. But in Burma itself, Lord Mountbatten's title is remembered and respected for reasons which that country finds it less easy to forget. Burma was where he began to change the course of history. As the last Viceroy of India in 1947, Mountbatten made what may well be acknowledged as his greatest mark on history. In this, he was, not for the first time, greatly aided and supported by his beautiful and brilliant wife, Edwina Mountbatten, whose memory is as greatly revered and perhaps even more deeply loved than Lord Mountbatten himself in India today. To rise in a profession, it is accepted that one must try hard, work hard, show keenness. And if one does all these things, and the rewards follow, inevitably people will accuse one of being merely ambitious.
Ambition's a very funny thing. I only had one conscious, clearly formed ambition. That was to rise to the top of my profession. And obviously to succeed as my father's First Sea Lord. I thought it would be very difficult, but I thought if I worked really hard, it should be attainable. I thought it would be wonderful after I'd been to India to be Viceroy of India, out of the question as a naval officer. I had a romantic feeling about the glamour of the Garter. I never thought I could get that. I thought the most worthwhile order was the OM. I knew that was out of my reach. I always loved the trooping of the colour, and I thought what fun it would be to ride as the Colonel of the Life Guards. The very last thing that ever into my mind was that it would happen. And there are many others of that sort I could mention. But basically, the main thing about ambition is it's fun to think of these things. It mustn't interfere with what you're doing. You must never let ambition interfere with a job in hand, which must be done for its own sake.
Whether intentions or only dreams, in the case of Lord Mountbatten, ambition has certainly been achieved. Admiral of the Fleet, Earl, Knight of the Garter, Privy Councillor, Order of Merit, GCB, GCSI, GCIE, etc. DSO, Honorary Lieutenant General and Air Marshal, Fellow of the Royal Society, Freeman of many cities, Elder Brother of Trinity House, Grand President of the British Commonwealth Ex-Service League, President of the Society of Film and Television Arts, Chairman and Founder of the National Electronics Council, Grand Cross of the Legion of Honor and the Croix de Guerre of France, and much else besides. Lord Mountbatten's talent is for action. Philosophizing does not come naturally to him. But out of his royal birth, the wealth which he inherited, and the wealth which came to him by marriage, his industry and his aptitudes, a philosophy of life did in time emerge. Whatever project might be in hand, whatever cause he might be fighting for, he has been sustained by the reflection that at bottom he had nothing to lose.
I care what people whose opinion I value think, and I'm worried if they think badly of me. But if the rank and file think I'm wrong, it doesn't disturb me in the least. If one went through life, particularly in high command, trying to do things because they were popular, if one had to gain votes or increase one's box office rating, I feel I couldn't be sincere. I would find it a very difficult discipline to learn to try just to please people. People either can take one because on the whole they appreciate one, or they can dislike one, or fear one, or despise one. It leaves me cold. All I want to know is, was I right? Were they wrong? If I was right, will they eventually come round and see it? Or are they so dumb that it will have to be their children or grandchildren who in 50 years' time realize that I was fairly reasonable and the people who thought I was wrong were unreasonable? Without this sort of self-confidence in high command, it would be difficult to carry on.